I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. We hear all the time about how dire everything is with regards to the environment. It still is, and more can be done, but it's not all hopeless. A new book, The New Eco Warriors, features 22 young men and women who are doing their part. The editor of the book, one of the 22 featured in the book, joins me now. Emily Hunter is the environmental correspondent for MTV News Canada and climate producer for the Real News Network in Washington. She is the daughter of Greenpeace co-founders Robert and Bobby Hunter, and she's worked on numerous campaigns from saving the whales in the Antarctic to protecting indigenous species in the Galapagos Islands. In the book, the 22 people write about their own experiences, their passions, the roots of their activism as well. Perhaps one can get inspired to do their own thing to help save this planet. This Friday, the 22nd, other than being Good Friday, is Earth Day. This book is a great way to think about the planet and our place in it. Do that while thinking about Jesus. The next Eco Warriors is published by Canary Press. The website is at nextechowarriors.com. Please welcome to the Plant Online program in Toronto this morning, Emily Hunter. Good morning, Ms. Hunter.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. Is Toronto home for you?
Yes, Toronto. I was born actually in Vancouver, but I was being raised out here in Toronto for a number of years.
So I assume you travel a lot, is that right?
Yeah, my parents were big travelers in their campaign, so I kind of followed that route and traveled myself.
Yeah, and so for work, are you based in Toronto, or do you go to Washington a lot, or how does that work?
Yeah, I'm flipping between both cities currently.
Yeah. So Friday is Earth Day. What does Earth Day mean to you? Is it a big deal?
Good question. I think to me, I know this is going to sound cheesy, but every day is Earth Day.
Yeah.
It really is. You know, I think one of the most important issues of our time right now is trying to safeguard our planet. We really are in such a critical time in history right now where we face the next 10, 15, 20 years. Well, we have a choice to either switch gears and really start thinking about surviving the next century ourselves and protecting not only the planet but ourselves, or continuing on the path that we're on and really seeing runaway climate change happen. So I think that this is really imperative time. But it's also, as you're saying, it's not all doom and gloom. There's also an incredible time going on because there really is a movement afoot right now, a movement that is growing, a movement that is youth-led, and a movement that is also, I believe, very much more inclusive to a lot more people.
Well, one of the things we hear a lot, especially in this country because we're in the midst of an election campaign, is that youth, young people, are apathetic, that we just don't care. That's not the case from what I've read in the book and these people that you profile, right?
Yeah, and I don't believe that's the case at all. I've read and met so many incredible young people from around the world, and I'm really seeing this charge of new generation of change makers on environmental justice issues and social justice issues from all around the world. I really feel like my generation is actually much more aware and exposed about global issues than any generation before it with the advance of the internet. I think that we're just getting information in different ways than previous generations. Instead of picking up the paper, we're getting news in posts on Facebook and Twitter and other social mediums. And we are aware of what's going on all around us. I think it's more that we are just not getting enough information of what to do. But there's this persistent question a lot of us are always asking, not just my generation, a lot of people are asking, what can we do to make a difference? And that dialogue really isn't being hashed out a lot of the time in our society. And this book, as well as other projects outside of my book and from other people as well, of course, is trying to tackle this kind of question of what can we do to make a difference. And I do this by kind of sharing examples and stories of what other people are doing.
So what can we do? I mean, we hear a lot from people that, I mean, something that I hear a lot is that it's difficult to change one's life, that we're afraid because change scares us first, and we're afraid that it'll cost a lot or change our lives dramatically. What's something that we can do that perhaps not as big as some of the things that some of the folks do in this book, but something that we can do in our lives at home, say?
Well, I have to say that I think what it really all comes down to is starting to kind of redefine what we think of change making. so that it's something that all of us can actually do in our lives. And I think that has to do with starting to use our own tools, skills, paid work even, to make some kind of change. But I do believe it needs to be some kind of significant change. We've had a, you know, a good, I don't know, 8 years now since kind of climate awareness and even Al Gore's film. Well, we're now aware of the issues. We're aware of what climate change is. We know this, what's going on. We've made some lifestyle choices. Maybe some people drive their hybrid cars, use less plastic bags, recycle here and there. And that's all great, and that's a good start. But I think it's now time we all need to take the next step. We need to not just be green consumers and green-minded, but green actionists, and really get involved in these issues. And as I say, it's just about using your own skill sets to make change and to drive change, just as these individuals in the book have.
There was something in the book that I read that I found interesting, and it has to do with ego, and our generation, yours and mine, Emily. It's sort of known as thought of as more egocentric than previous ones, what with social media, social networking, and the sort. And as we all know, ego is sort of the downfall of any movement. Do you foresee a problem, say, dealing with ego in the environmental movement?
No, it's an interesting question. I mean, absolutely, throughout the history, and looking at the history of the environmental movement, it has been ego so much of the time that has driven the divisions and really crippled and made the death of the environmental movement during the 80s and 90s, I would say. And certainly, I mean, that could happen again, drive those kinds of divisions instead of unify people, and that's really where we need to go, is build a more unified front in this mass movement. At the same time, I mean, yeah, we are the Facebook generation. You know, we want our recognition. And this book is kind of about giving that recognition to the next generation, new faces and voices. So, I mean, I kind of think, like the Internet, like technology, like so many things in life, it can be a friend and a foe. I think we just need to be critical-minded of it. I think giving recognition to people isn't necessarily a bad thing, and isn't necessarily a bad thing to even more next eco worries outside of this book. Celebrating what people are doing on these different fronts, I think, is a great thing, and it can help share their stories and inspire others as well. So I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing, but of course it can turn into that if it's all about egomania. So it definitely depends on intentions, right? If it's intentions to celebrate and inspire a movement, or intentions to just drive home one single person as a celebrity and, you know, really drive these divisions in a movement. So we have to be critical of it, for sure.
So I was reading about some of the people in the book, and you just can't help but be inspired by some of their stories and moved by some of their stories. How did you come to know all the? I mean, you know all of these people, do you? You've met them all?
No, actually, I would say a good 60-70% I do not.
Yeah.
It was research over the years. I was just constantly looking for young, even not that young, sometimes they're in their 30s, eco-activists from all around the world. The driving factor for me for picking the people that I did was I wanted to represent the diversity in the movement, diversity of tactics and diversity of perspectives and people from all around the world, and really show what this movement was all about now. So that was a major factor for me, and just researching them and getting connected with them via email, we were able to share their story that way, even though I've never actually met them in person.
So you contacted them and told them that you wanted them to write something for the book, right?
Yeah, I put together my idea, my pitch. It certainly evolved over the years, but I just started off. I started off with a few friends of mine because they were people that had inspired me, and I knew that there was these young people out there that were kind of what kept me going during my dark hours as an activist, as long as I kept hearing about the inspiring stories. But then after that, it just did some research, getting my pitches, my proposals, and people were very keen about the project and very responsive. So the ones that did submit work in the end, we edited it down with them and over the course of a couple of years, and we were able to finally narrow it down to these 22 chapters.
Now, the term Echo Hunter, that's something that your dad came up with, right?
Echo Warrior. Yeah, that was a term.
Echo Warrior, yeah, pardon me.
No worries. That was a term my father coined, actually. I know some people might say that that's a big term to kind of coin, but he really did. He wrote a book called Warriors of the Rainbow back in 1979, and this was after a Cree mythology that when the skies turned dark from pollution, when we could say, or the ocean is so toxic and the animals are falling flat dead at the scene, that people will come together finally after they felt the time where they had kind of lost their spirit, but they will finally come together almost during the 11th hour, if you will, people from all around the world reflecting that rainbow, and will unite and save the world. My father believed at the time, in the 1960s, 70s, that was that time. I believe that was the foundation, but I believe it's now that kind of mythology may be coming true. I hope it is. But that was when I wanted to take the coin termed eco-warrior, meaning this eco-fighter for the planet, and really say the next eco-warriors are here and say almost that mythology might be coming true now.
Well, what about this idea, though, that you talk about this in your introduction to the book, about previous generations, and you talk about our parents, who before us, you know, tried to steer humanity from the edge decades ago. But, you know, as you say in the book, here we are even closer to it. What happened there? Did something go wrong?
You know, it has to do, I think, a lot with losing the movement in many ways. I don't think they did anything per se wrong. They made great feats. I mean, they stopped nuclear testing. They put a moratorium against killing whales. They did the Montreal Protocol, and you know they've done so many amazing feats. So I don't know if I would say that their movement failed. But the movement was lost in the 80s and 90s, and that had to do a lot with because a lot of these NGOs became very much greater and bigger. And they've done a lot of great work, but their focus became more on lobbying and top-end change rather than from the bottom up. And if you look at their history, I mean, the greatest significant changes always happen from mass mobilizations of people, mass movements on the ground level. That's happened in the suffrage movement, the civil rights movement. I mean, in Gandhi's time, it was mass movements always that make the most significant change. And so while we've lobbied and lobbied and lobbied, well, things have just gotten a lot worse. They haven't gotten better. And I blame that because we've lost the movement. And we need to now build that movement again if we're going to make the changes again.
And one of the things that's come up in recent years, I guess in the last decade, and you know, I guess we feel it more than, say, previous years, is this war that one has to fight not only to do the things that you all want to do, but you have this sort of misinformation. It's become an industry. You know, you have climate change deniers. And just thinking about that and what they do, I mean, it's quite an industry in of itself, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's why I do kind of go into not only the warrior ideology, but the war ideology. And I don't shy away from calling it a battle, calling it a war. It is a fight, and there are people on different sides. And the people that I think that we are battling against, the biggest ones, are people behind the scenes, too, are the elites, the ones that have the power. The rest of us who are working for the man, if you will, and the ones that have the majority of the money and the power and pulling the strings in Washington and Ottawa and so forth, and the ones that are behind the major corporations like BP, like the fossil fuel industry, like Monsanto, you name it. I mean, these people are all in for it for short-term profits and do not care about our lives, do not care about the planet, do not care about longevity. They care about short-term profits. That's it. So yes, I do believe it's a war, and it's a war with those kinds of people.
Now, your piece in the book, you begin by talking about being in Copenhagen in 2009 at the climate conference there. Refresh our memory, that wasn't a good time for the climate change movement, right?
No, it wasn't a good time for the climate change movement or the planet. Yeah. It was a pretty dark time. It being pitted as our best and last chance to save the world. This had been the moment that Obama had just gotten into power. He was really leading the charge. It looked like the U.S. was finally going to get on board and lead the charge into making a real climate deal happen, putting forth climate legislation in the U.S., and then the world would follow and echo what the U.S. was doing. It was an exciting time, and I remember feeling very, very optimistic. I look back now, I feel a little bit naive, but I felt very optimistic at the time, and I think a lot of us did. 100,000 activists and people had come from all around the world to be there, and about 30,000-40,000 delegates were inside trying to influence the decisions being made, and nearly 200 leaders, almost all the world leaders, were there. So it was an incredible time, and even with all of that behind it, the moment was lost. It was lost for many reasons, partly because of the divisions between all the different countries, and it's incredibly hard to unify all the world leaders in one big Band-Aid solution. It was lost. Also, I would think it was lost because the U.S. really couldn't lead. It really couldn't go about setting global legislation until there was domestic legislation, or things would have backfired back in the U.S. and nothing really would have happened anyways. And that was held back. Obama was held back in many ways because of a few select senators, and again, a few select elite in the U.S. that was holding Washington and holding Obama and holding the whole world behind. They kept saying then afterwards, next year, next year. Well, I went to the UN Mexico Climate Summit, and that was even more depressing. Quite frankly, I'm not sure if we're going to have that big Band-Aid solution. I think we need to stop focusing our attention on the world leaders saving it all and putting pressure on them to make all the changes. I get that's what ultimately needs to happen, but right now I think we need to build the movement that propels and pushes these leaders to do it, or just build a movement to make our own change ourselves. We got to stop focusing on the politicians to save the world, because they're frankly not going to, and I saw that very clearly in Copenhagen.
Now, you mentioned earlier about how it's Earth Day for you every day. Growing up with Bob Hunter and your mom, you had this environmental stuff all around you, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, my parents were the co-founders of Greenpeace, and my father was the first president. My mother was the first woman to save a whale. So I definitely grew up with a lot of this. At the same time, though, I also grew up more with the media part of my father's life, because he had later transitioned to becoming an environmental reporter. And so the environment was there as I was raised, but I actually more thought I was going to get involved in filmmaking and other kind of media work. The environment was just kind of something that was in my life, but I didn't know if I was actually going to go into that direction. It wasn't really until I kind of traveled myself and been exposed to enough that I saw the one consistent thing I was seeing in my travels was environmental destruction. Smog in the air, animals treated and exploited for game and torture purposes, human beings actually getting killed too because they couldn't keep up with development in parts of the world. I'd seen enough, and then I finally kind of decided that I needed to be my own activist. I needed to be a change maker myself, and that probably the most important thing I, and I think any of us, can really do is try to make a difference for something bigger than ourselves, not just propel our own careers and self-interest, but try to do something bigger, try to do something better for something bigger than ourselves and for a greater cause. I think one of the most important one is protecting our own very home. There's nothing bigger than that, and protecting our own very survival.
And that's obviously something that you learned from Robert Hunter. What's something else that those of us that know of him, but know little about him, that would serve us well, say?
Sure. I feel like my father, even though he is well-known in some ways, I think he is an unsung hero in many other ways. I mean, he really was the leader, and I'm going to say it, he was the leader behind Greenpeace. He took a group that was just focused on anti-nuclear issues called Don't Make a Wave Committee, and it was trying to stop nuclear testing of Aleutian Islands. He not only got on the boat and got tons of media attention surrounding it, but then when they had success in their campaign and were kind of thinking of dithering down, he knew that once they had that attention that they should continue on, and they should continue to all kinds of environmental issues. And so he actually propelled the group. He didn't invent the name Greenpeace, but he did rename it. He then wanted it to be a global group, and he wanted it to focus on nature. So he propelled the anti-whaling campaign. And it really made this, what was just an anti-nuclear group, into this global multi-issue environmental organization. I don't think a lot of people really understand just how vital a role he really had in that. And so he helped lead this amazing organization into being. He helped make sure that there was a moratorium for whaling. He helped stop nuclear testing. He helped protect seals. And later he fought against climate change. So, I mean, he's been a huge, huge role in Canada and a major role player in the modern-day environmental movement. And he really did play a major role.
Did you grow up in Vancouver?
No, I was only born there, and I was actually taken off to Toronto when I was about 3 or 4 years old. My father went into becoming the eco reporter in City TV.
What's next for you, Emily?
Well, I'm being asked to be part of a couple different campaigns. There is one that I've applied for called Deforest Action, where it's going to be taking 5 months to go and protect the rainforest of Borneo and orangutans in Borneo. that are basically getting hacked down for palm oil and Dove soap products. And it's a youth-led project, and it's going to be developed by youth. So I've applied for that, and there's also some other campaigns I may be joining us to protect against protect marine conservation and to fight against climate change. So there's lots of work to be done, and I'm excited to be a part of it.
Emily, thanks for this, and happy Earth Day. Good luck with this book and the other important work that you do.
Thank you very much.
The book is called The Next Eco Warriors, 22 Young Women and Men Who Are Saving the Planet. Canary Press is its publisher. The website for more, nextecowarriors.com. Emily Hunter, its editor, on the line from Toronto and Vancouver. I'm Joseph Potter.